Okay, yes. Well, at least I'm going to say some probably trivial things to most of the people in the audience about active networks. So I guess I'm going to try to motivate this with some spiel on cell movement and mechanics, essentially trying to at least say that understanding better sort of active systems will be a sort of a good step towards understanding better sort of fundamental processes in cell locomotion and things like in cell division. And going with the theme of the program, I'm going to talk about semi-flexible polymers and kind of review the rheology of semi-flexible polymers, which you've already heard a lot from different people. Oh yeah.
You need that?
No, I don't need that at all, actually.
You lift up on the no,
no,
you
this.
stop the clock.
Look,
Lift up on that.
yeah. Okay. And then finally go on to talking about sort of active polymers. And hopefully I'll get a chance to talk about two things. One sort of active crosslinks and then sort of just active kickers. Then let's move to conclusion. So that's first year biology cell. And well, it's obviously very complicated and different people are going to talk about different things. But I'm really interested in just two bits of this of the cycle, essentially the behavior of sort of actin filaments and proteins associated with it. And so, yeah. So basically, when we think of these sort of filaments forming a sort of cytoskeleton of the cell. And now, as Jay already pointed out, the kind of the actin cytoskeleton is very important for lots of properties of denied properties of cells. But what he didn't talk about, what he talked about really was just actin by itself. Whilst actually we know that generally there are other proteins working with actin. And one of the proteins which works with actin is the molecular motor myosin. And basically, if I was looking for some images, but they're images from the Borisy lab where they looked at, for example, this is a keratocyte, a fish skin cell, and they looked at essentially the concentrations of myosin as it was going retrograde flow, and they saw basically that the myosin concentration was very dynamic and moving all the time. And so it seems that the dynamics of myosin and actin seems to be important in cell locomotion. And this is a moving keratocyte, and this is from the Borisy lab. Again, they've got really nice images on their website. And this is a sort of a focus on the leading edge. And of course, and you see that it's a highly entangled mesh of actin filaments. And you can see that essentially, if you look at the mesh size seems to be much smaller than the persistence length. Okay. Now, again, here's another. Here again, to talk about the importance of myosin. Here this is an image from Titus' lab, and this is basically dictyostelium. And in this case, it's got myosin 1b, and there myosin 1b has been knocked out. And you see that basically when it has myosin 1b, essentially, which is one of the family myosin, it essentially seems to be able to move coherently. And without myosin 1b, it seems to just form these pods in a sort of totally random way. So, sorry? Well, I think I can give you the reference, but I think they have a program which they've written, which sort of, so that this bit is a lamellipodia. I don't know how they've labeled it somehow. The green bit is the nucleus, and the blue bit is the rest of the cell. And they've developed a program which takes an image of the cell and generates these kind of images. And they have several images on their website.
So that's the real shape of the cell, like just the height of the red portion is really the height of the melanocortin.
I imagine so, yes.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So, what's going on? So, okay, the things that I'm interested in are actin and myosin, and basically, actin we've heard a lot about. We know it's this double-stranded helical polymer made up of monomers of G-actin, and myosin is the molecular motor. Now, usually, what has been essentially characterized has been called this S1 subfragment of myosin. Essentially, it seems easier to crystallize myosin that way. So basically, you can cut this section of myosin molecule, which corresponds essentially to this. And basically, people have been able to identify an ATP pocket, an actin binding site, and this is called the heavy chain. And then there's something called the light chain, which is much longer. And it's this chain which causes myosin to form aggregates. Actin is polar, so there's a plus end and minus end, as Jay told us a few days ago. And it has diameter of about 7 nanometers. And a persistence length around 15 microns. Now, so what happens when actin and myosin get together? Now, actually, in our muscles, we know that basically we have sort of long strands of actin and myosin which form sarcomeres, and basically muscle contraction comes from this interaction of actin and myosin because of ATP. Now, this is a sort of schematic of what happens. It's not, I guess there is still controversy about what exactly the mechanism of force generation in the actin myosin system is, but a good enough cartoon as other is that essentially myosin binds actin in the presence of ADP. It gets into a strained state. Then this strain can be released when it releases ADP, it can relax that strain, and then it takes up an ATP in order to unbind, and it goes through the cycle again. And basically, what happens when you die is that you run out of ATP, and the actins in your muscles just bind to the myosin, and you become stiff. Sorry? You become rigorous. You become rigorous, yeah. So, it's very interesting about, well, people say things about mathematicians, but I am not going to say anything. Yeah?
The spring expands, and it stretches, or is it just to... It's not really relevant.
Oh. What is that?
In the middle, you have the stretch spring, and then I do
the top. Okay. So basically, what's usually said is that when the myosin binds to the actin, it's got ADP and phosphate, and then this is the phosphate release, which somehow causes it cocks it.
But does the actin move to the left or to the right?
Okay, so I guess this is probably a schematic. So I don't want to support it too strongly. It may be that actually that it should rather be a compressed spring than an extended spring.
The movement there is more realistic.
Yeah.
Okay. The size of the
it's yeah.
only symbolic.
It's all symbolic. Yeah. Okay. And okay, so basically, I just give a sort of history of experiments on actin. So essentially, there's been a number of mechanical experiments on purified actin, which have been done over the last 10 years by some of the people who are in the audience. and who, and basically it seemed that now there is sort of a consensus of what the properties are. And basically, recently there have been a number of new experiments where people have taken actin, purified actin, and added different types of myosin, and which is the results of coming out. And it basically seems to be there's no theory around. And so basically that was our motivation for trying to study this. We thought, well, let's see whether we can find out whether there's any interesting things that can come out of studying the system. So typical experiment is a rheological experiment. We've heard a lot about that. Apply a time-dependent strain and measure a shear stress. And a typical example is, let's say, two plates and with a relative velocity between them. And an interesting experiment is to actually, rather than to do the experiment in time space, to do in frequency space, and essentially, this is nice because it decomposes essentially the shear modulus into two parts. A part which is in phase, elastic, and a part which is out of phase, which is called the loss modulus, which measures the viscous properties of the material. So what are the goals that we want to address? And so what we want to find out is essentially what happens to the viscoelasticity of an F-actin solution if we add myosin 2 or an S1 myosin, which is another type of myosin, and ATP. And essentially we want to develop a microscopic theory in the sort of which can explain the viscoelastic response of these solutions. And the way in which we're going to do that is essentially to compare the response of a mix of actin, myosin, and ATP with just actin. And we're going to make lots of unjustified approximations and assumptions. So I've got my bulletproof vest on, so I'm expecting lots of dissent. So basically, this is a sort of simple man's area of rheology. So if you have flexible polymers, this is a standard picture. You have essentially a short time regime when the polymers behave as if they're free, and then there's at some time, which is what you call entanglement time, then these polymers feel the entanglements and the stress cannot relax, and you have a plateau which eventually relaxes via reptation. And so there's essentially sort of three important things here. There is essentially entanglement time, which is roughly when it moves from essentially free chain behavior to essentially behavior confined by the rest of the chains. Plateau modulus, the amount of stress that's relaxed after a step strain, and repetition time, which is the longest relaxation time in the system. So actin is a semi-flexible polymer. So unlike flexible polymers, where one could just consider it to be essentially some kind of freely jointed chain, we need to include the effects of bending. So the simplest model is called the Wurm-like chain model, where we just essentially have a penalty for bending, and it's square because it has to respect that because of symmetry. And usually the stretching modulus is much higher than the bending modulus, so essentially we can consider it to be an extensible. And we can characterize it by essentially a tiny correlation function, which has an exponential decay with a typical length scale, which is called LP, which is related to the rigidity. It's the ratio of rigidity, and KT gives this length, which is the persistence length. So basically on length scale less than LP, it's a rod. On some length of the order of LP, it's something semi-flexible, and on lengths lot longer than LP, it's a coil. So how does one develop a microscopic theory of the elastic response of semi-flexible polymer solutions? Well, what we have to do is we have to have a develop a macroscopic theory for the dynamics of semi-flexible polymers. So, and we need to understand how these polymers respond to external perturbations, such as a shear. So, the simplest model, sort of a Rouse-like model, we essentially balance the viscous friction with the elastic force and the thermal forces. So, basically, if there is an external perturbation such as a shear flow, the viscous forces have this form. We have essentially a drag friction viscous friction. We have a bending elasticity term, which is just bending. And basically, because the polymer is inextensible, we have to introduce a Lagrange multiplier, which essentially imposes the constraint of inextensibility, and we have thermal forces. In the presence of myosin, we're going to say that there are going to be an additional active forces, which we're going to specify later. And this Lagrange multiplier, this tension, is specified by imposing this constraint. And actually, this is a hard problem to solve, as many people here know, and so one has to make some approximations or some tricks to solve it. This is for free. This is free. So what I want to look now is at the high frequency behavior, where I'm going to assume that the chain is essentially free. Okay. I hope this is clear. So a way in which we can proceed is to essentially to take this semi-flexible polymer and break it up into sections, which, if you want, on length of which is somehow less than LP, and on this length scale, we could decompose motion into essentially a parallel component and a perpendicular component, and essentially we're doing an expansion about a rod. So, basically we're going to assume that basically this perpendicular deviation from a rod, and this parallel deviation from the rod are very small. So this is a sort of a weakly bending rod, and this is a regime which allows one to proceed. So basically, in this regime, it's been known for a very long time that the perpendicular fluctuations go like 2 to the 1/4, and recently it has been shown numerically and also sort of analytically that taking into account viscous friction generates a new dynamic length scale, which is for the relaxation of longitudinal fluctuations. So I'm just going to sort of go through a sketch of the physics behind that. So usually, what has sort of been done until quite recently is basically to ignore the inextensibility constraint. Not really ignore it, but essentially ignore this term in the dynamics and calculate the fluctuations of the perpendicular dynamic, which then becomes a linear equation. And then to calculate the dynamics of the parallel motion by imposing the inextensibility constraint, ignoring totally this equation, which essentially takes into account the longitudinal friction. This is in some sense is consistent, but not for all times. Because obviously for short times, there will not be having time for essentially for information to have been propagated by along the chain due to the longitudinal friction. So basically, the sort of the main technical sort of thing behind this is really trying to deal with this these three equations in a self-consistent way, so that we can actually say something about the dynamics of these polymers. I don't know why.
Screensaver.
Okay. Okay. So the way in which we're going to try to, at least in some way, take account of this equation is to basically to solve this first equation perturbatively in the tension, using the transmissibility constraint to relate this motion and the tension, and to put that back into the third equation, and that way close the set of equations. So the way in which, okay, I'm doing this because I've had a lot of discussion with people about this over the last few days, and so I think it might be interesting for people to really see my spin on it. So basically, we're not going to ignore the tension, but we're going to actually include it, and so we can write down a dynamic for the perpendicular motion, taking into account this tension from the Lagrange multiplier, imposing an extensibility, and averaging over the perpendicular fluctuations, we can get essentially, that means that effectively works out at essentially perturbatively expanding in the tension. So we're going to calculate the perpendicular fluctuations for a prescribed tension using that we can using the extensibility constraint, which if you recall related the parallel motion to the perpendicular motion, we can obtain essentially a kernel relating the tension and the parallel motion. And it's interesting, this thing in the Fourier transform of this is really the local strain. So what we're really relating is the tension to a local strain. And it's possible to calculate this kernel, and it has this form. And it was calculated, I mean, essentially it was calculated by David and Fred some years ago. But there are sort of corrections of this form. And then use.
It's linear response.
Yeah. So essentially, put it something that says. Sorry?
K is something related to the B of omega?
The K is basically the K is B, it's the inverse of B. But it's the B, the full B, the non-local B, not the local B. Okay. And then using this equation, we can now put so we now have a linear relationship between the parallel motion and the tension. We now have an equation for the parallel motion, which we can put the tension in, and we can close our set of equations. And this is very similar to what David talked about the first day, but some of us weren't here then, so it might be interesting to go over that. And also, what is important here, and which is important particularly for the active systems, is that we don't average straight away over the over the noise. So essentially, in this picture, we allow the system to have tension fluctuations, whilst in the picture David talked about a week and a half ago, you average sits away. So what you calculate is an equation for the average tension. What we can do by keeping this is actually calculate not only the average tension but fluctuations about the average tension, and in the active system would turn out we will argue that is very important in the active system. Okay. So that was dynamics of free semi-flexible polymers. And so what happens when you have an entangled mesh? So now it seems the only successful sort of idea which has come across, which came already some 40 years ago, Sam Edwards, of one was to say basically that we can replace this mass of entangled polymers by essentially a tube. And we could do the same thing for semi-flexible polymers as was done for flexible polymers, but unlike the flexible polymer case, we have another length scale. In the flexible polymer situation, there's only one length scale, which is the mesh size. Here, there is another length scale, the persistence length. This gives you an ambiguity.
Yeah. In flexible things as well, there's enormous ambiguity in the diameter of the tube.
Yes, of course.
So people like Rubinstein spent years trying to work out.
It's
not clear that.
But I would say that still, at least at a scaling level, people feel. I mean, I would say because the diameter of the tube determines the modulus. So presumably you can relate the ratio of how the tube diameter varies with concentration by looking at how the modulus varies with concentration, I guess. But
people have spent about a week arguing about the tube diameter of flexible polymers.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Yeah, I'm sure that the other people will.
It's not simple.
Yeah.
It's
interesting to note when you look up the measurements by Newton reflection, by reflection. Of flexible polymers by Richter, very careful measurements. At the same time, when we use this is acting Richter Schmidt, he actually gets the same power as you get with light scattering acting filaments. So on these length scales, you see also something like persistence lengths. It's not really flexible, it's warm like, or the length scales of 10 angstroms.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
A lot of fighting with Richter, telling him that.
See, I've got a very cool screensaver, so therefore you're paying for that.
For the mesh size, there are different expressions whether you use scaling or mean field. Scaling is concentration. Is this
cube one? I'm not aware of.
She's talking about flexible chains.
Flexible chains.
Are you talking about
volume effects?
Yeah.
Mm. These are very thick. Okay. Yeah. So I should say that one of the things that we're going to assume that this mesh size is much smaller than the persistence length. So basically as we saw in the picture at the beginning, it was really like it looked almost like a network of sticks. Okay, so one way, of course, there is some ambiguity in choosing this, but one way of deciding how to characterize a tube is to say the tube, because we have two length scales, the tube must be characterized by two parameters, and usually the two parameters are the tube diameter, which I'm going to call DE, and something called the deflection length, which is something like an entanglement length. But maybe entanglement is not a good word to use for these systems. So a nice way to see that is just to say that, well, basically, if we could think of the entangled network as a kind of lattice, the mesh size is basically the lattice spacing. And basically, we know that we can say the deflection length is roughly the length scale over which we have one collision of the polymer with its tube. So basically, we could relate very simply the product of the tube diameter and the deflection length as the mesh size squared. And the mesh size related to the concentration of monomers and the diameter.
So they're both proportional to each other, so in the echo prefactor.
No, sorry?
But they're both related to each other by numerical prefactor. Or
which the tube diameter and the
diameter and the spacing.
No, I mean for the semiflex polymer, it's not, because semiflex polymer the fluctuations in this direction are not the same as fluctuations in that direction. So so it's you get the transverse fluctuations scale differently. They don't scale linearly with the length.
Both lengths are characteristic of a mesh, not of a chain.
Well, the point is that this length is basically if you think of the polymer as being in a tube. If you think of a semiflex polymer in a tube, there's something called a deflection length, because basically, if you try to, you can find out at which length scale the bending allows it to vary that radius.
Okay.
So basically, there is another length. I mean, there's another length scale, and that's determined by the persistence length. That's what makes it ambiguous. And these formulas, I must say, are by no means cast in stone. I think different people, some people don't believe them. No, I would say that I believe them, but.
So deflection lens is somehow equivalent to entanglement lens. Just different terminology.
Well, it's. I don't think it's the same. I don't think it's. I think it's.
Maximum polymer is equal to one length. So you feel that parallel is equal to perpendicular. Mm-hmm. The distance between entanglement and parallel.
The distance is.
But here is what is often called the entanglement length. Badly.
Yeah.
You can call it a contact.
Yeah. I think Odai calls it deflection length, which I think is the best name for it. It's really just like if you have a membrane confined between two plates, there's also a typical length scale.
Deflection length grows, then chain becomes more rigid.
The deflection length, goes like, size LP is bigger than XI, so yeah, it's very weak.
But it can become arbitrarily large relative to C.
Yeah.
In the level.
Yeah. Right, so it scales with.
I'm more confused now. So you're telling me deflection lens and entanglement lens are not the same, and somebody was talking about some deflection lens. You're pointing out that equation. So just how different are they? I'm not too sure.
Okay, so the same thing. Okay, it's just another term. But I just say that maybe entanglement is not a good idea it's not a good word in this system. But okay, that's an entanglement length, and it's called LE.
But when you use the word PR, you actually mean deflection length. They are actually equivalent.
People identify the deflection as entanglement. Some people hear it wrong.
Yeah.
It's called
it deflection. What's called it?
Yeah, so blame them. I just read their papers.
Geometrically, it's a deflection length. It happens that it also sets the modulus, so you tend to call it a rectangular length, but they're different words for the same thing.
Okay. So again.
I just wanted to clarify that.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so. So I guess, again, I want to just stress that the mesh size is related to the square root of the monomer concentration. Okay. So how do we calculate the stress in such a system? Well, there is a formula due to Kramer's or Kirkwood, for which you can calculate the stress in, if you want, in a set of fluctuating beads. So basically, essentially this is because basically you could arbitrarily choose any plane to make a cut if you have an anisotropic distribution of such beads. So basically, you can a macroscopic. It's a relatively simple, but maybe slight tedious calculation to show that. The stress is related essentially to look, the force on each, if you want, bead, in the stress in direction ij is the force in direction I multiplied by the position of the bead in the direction j. And this is sort of related to what Tom was talking about when he was talking about the stress tensor in the gas, was that when you made a plane and you looked at the momentum transfer across the plane. This is something similar. So basically now, since we had, from the dynamics of the semiconductor polymer, we balance essentially the viscous forces with the elastic forces. So with the left-hand side was, so basically we know the forces on the polymer, and we know its position, and so we can actually calculate this average. So using the dynamics, the fluctuation dynamics that we developed before, it's now we can basically plug this back in to calculate the stress in a solution, isotropic solution of such polymers. And again, this is I'm using David's notation. This stress, essentially, I'm going to argue that if you take account of tension fluctuations, there's an additional component to the stress which has been ignored, which is due to fluctuations in tension. And so this stress, which is David called tension stress, was calculated both by David and Fred and explains the high frequency response of semi-flexible polymer solutions. There is, I have not, I don't, my stresses are not exactly the same as the stresses you've defined, but I guess qualitatively they are, but I think I've grouped my terms in a slightly different way. And also, there are additional terms which I have ignored, but which at linear response are not important. So, for calculating linear risk elasticity, the other terms can be shown to not contribute.
Something I don't understand here. I thought you said the tension fluctuates, but it's mean you integrate for you have your first integral tension stress.
Yeah.
Why is the mean non-zero?
When you apply shear flow, the mean
when
is
you apply, so it includes the applied.
Yeah, this is the stress for an arbitrary system, and then I'm going to calculate this. I'm going to take the dynamic what we calculated before, which was zero stress. And I put it in an applied.
So where does the fluctuations in stress enter, if they enter anymore? I mean, fluctuations in tension that you mentioned.
Yeah, well, they will enter in that. When you calculate this correlation function in linear response, you'll see that there will be a contribution.
Small L.
Okay, now what I've done is I've arbitrarily split the polymer into little sections of length L, which are smaller than persistence length.
The normal way of writing tension stress might be to write if S is a monomer coordinate, then you'd write ds, a force which is an orientation times a tension, ut, and then dr, ds.
Mm-hmm.
The uu, yeah. Actually, one of the two terms has a length associated with it. Because
it's a unit vector from the force, and then the second vector, drds, and that, and that's the variation length that you're separating out as longitudinal stress. Okay. I'm not sure how that's like different.
There's a more micro.
Yeah.
There's a. This is. Let me see. This is done in an expansion around a straight line.
Yeah.
whereas I guess I wrote it down literally in terms of link vectors. So the two expressions have got to be related.
Yes. So I think the I would assume that there's probably a slight difference. There must be some small difference between the two, but I don't think it's big. But
well, let me see. So you both of us are just starting from RF and treating it exactly.
Yeah.
Aside from entropic terms.
There's U terms, and I mean, it's even interesting that when you include activity, you find that you get additional, you get things that look like entropy,
okay,
as well.
The only difference I see is that you're using your parameterization, your expansion around a straight line, to express the stress, whereas I did everything in a form that's independent of a frame of reference in terms of just the link vectors of discrete chain. And neither of us, we're both planning to make no approximations. So if we both got it right, they must be equivalent, and it's just a matter of parameterization. Do you buy this?
I guess that must be true.
The distinction is that the U, the more microscopic expression U, what you actually have for the tension stress is UU. Lambda, the whole thing averaged, where U is the local orientation of a bit
chain. Chain, yes.
These are global.
And your U's are global.
Well, yeah, my U's, I've somehow taken out the, I've said that I'm looking at time scales for which these U's are not changing very much. I mean, I think that's...
But it's a question of whether the local theory with a local orientation.
Because what I'm saying, I guess I'm splitting up my chain into little sections of, with.
Right.
So I don't.
The fact that the chain contracts longitudinally is related to the fact that little pieces of it do rotate things.
Yes.
And so I'm assuming that what you're writing down makes sense, but you have a term that wasn't there in the other derivation, and it seemed. The only way I can see that it came about is just because you're using a global U rather than a local one. I guess neither of us looked at this in detail. That's something we could both check.
Check, yeah. Okay.
Like if I try to visualize this, if I think of it as a worm-like filament that's infinitely long, how do I imagine what is the so-called longitudinal stress? And why isn't that equivalent to tensional stress? I guess my question, give me a kind of a picture how I can visualize so-called longitudinal stress.
Okay, so you're saying that what's the difference between, why are there fluctuations in tension? Is that what you're saying? Or?
I understand the fluctuation in tension, which gives tensional stress. But I don't understand the longitudinal stress, what that means. If you think of an infinitely long filament in a viscous tube.
So you see that if there is no shear, the tension stress is zero. Because basically it's okay. I would say that in the absence of shear, this longitudinal stress seems would somehow contribute to an isotropic. It's a kind of contribution to the isotropic stress. Basically, I'd say that it's sort of analogous to this one, but for the it's related to the differences in the if you want the typical longitudinal fluctuations that that you would have if you had no stress. That the stress not only changes the mean tension, but it also changes the fluctuations in tension. Sorry, if you want, the strain. So
it would be good to think about how you go from the microscopic picture to this picture. It would help you understand the difference between sigma 1 and sigma 3.
If you had a chain in which the original expression was an average let me call the overall vector n rather than
so this is local u.
U, and I'll use your notation lambda. Imagine a chain in which they did like this, that fluctuated around lambda, that fluctuated around n, in which local u fluctuated, causing an overall contraction in the overall extension. Then, so in one case that you can see the distinction between them is between if lambda is constant, but u fluctuates, just to give an idealized situation, then the process of averaging over this would give something different than just nn. And apparently, he says, and I've not worked this out, gives something like that. Is that, do you buy that?
Yeah.
Okay, sorry to interrupt.
And what I say is that, what's interesting is that this is actually very small, because generally speaking, fluctuations are tension are very small. So this is actually it's much the smallest of all these three terms. So actually it's not important at all for the general polymer case, but I'm going to argue that it can become important when you have...
Why at high frequencies it's not important for the mean square displacement? I mean, because, I mean, your claim is that it's very, very short time. For example, if I look at the end, I see that it's still to the 7/8 or, I mean, all this. So why if you go to high frequency, I mean, you have a frequency finally. Isn't it the same argument that it should come in high frequencies?
Well, I guess the point that it will be there.
It's the same. Well, dimensionally, it's because this R parallel is varying over this tension propagation length, which is much longer than the R perpendicular.
So this allows one to calculate the shear modulus, and these are the well-known terms. So you can, at least for short times, you have a term which goes like t to the minus 3/4, which dominates. And as I said, this length is much larger than the others, so this term is subdominant. And so basically, this term is not important for a normal semi-flexible polymer solution. Yeah.
For t very small, it is important. So it's just a question of time scale, no?
It's important in the same way that this one is important. I mean, yeah.
It's just a question of frequency.
You see frequencies, yes.
Okay. So it's the same idea as the MSD.
Yes, basically.
Short times, you say the last one?
No way.
No. It's 1/8.
It's 1. Yes, 1/8.
No.
Yeah, but there's
another one.
It's left. Okay. It's.
No, it's not five.
No, it's 1/8. But I guess the problem is that here we have an LP squared on top.
But just in terms of time, it doesn't, at short times, it's less singular than the first time.
Yeah.
It doesn't dominate.
This is the one that this one has a steeper slope.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay.
So we don't have to worry about this term.
Yes.
So you're going to tell us what situation we have to worry about this term because you meant it.
Okay. And okay. So basically, this is just going over sort of what David was explaining. There was that basically the tension is really coming from these kind of modes. Curvatures from these modes, origination from these modes, and actually, okay. So, and this is sort of the classic picture of the shear modulus for semi-flexible polymers. Okay, there's this teeth minus three quarters behavior which dominates up to this plateau. And David has said that this plateau is very small, so therefore we can sort of you can basically push this curve here, and then depending on whether the polymers are longer than or less than persistence length. You get different plateaus. So when it's long in the persistence length, the plateau is given by this entanglement length, and when it's less than persistence length, this plateau is given by this length of the rods, and the relaxation time goes like L squared LP and L cubed. So now this is an image from Yusuf Kez's lab, and this is a solution of actin and myosin, and he's fluorescently labeled the actin and the myosin with the different dyes, and so basically there you could see. Essentially, a myosin cluster moving, okay, this moving to one filament with respect to another. So, basically, the question is how does this effect of this modify the behavior of a semi-flexible polymer solution? So basically the idea is that myosin forms aggregates because of the long tail. So basically because of this heavy myosin tail, so the myosin will tend to form aggregates, and these aggregates would can attach to the actin filaments, and if we sort of think of them as big bunches of myosin, then despite the fact that myosin is a non-processive motor, we can imagine that these things can walk along because there are several of them. And you can imagine that you have one kick and it's diffusing around, and before it has time to go away, another one could kick. So anyway, there would be a tendency of them to migrate along the chains. Now, because the chains are entangled, the motion in the perpendicular direction is severely constrained. So they would tend to apply forces in the longitudinal direction.
Whether you have a bunch of them or not, i.e. whether it's processive actively or not, shouldn't be too important.
I mean, it's not.
The filaments themselves are polar, so all the kicks are going to be in one. Whenever they are kicked, it's going to be in one direction.
Yes. So. But I'm saying that I think it will be even a stronger effect than you would expect than if you just assume that the kicks were random. What I'm saying is that yes, obviously you don't need.
Obviously, the more motors, sure.
Yeah. I'm saying that you don't need. I think you don't need to have clumps, but I think that okay. From the experiments, and it seems that there are clumps, which is natural because we tend to clump. Okay. And so first thing is that they're applying kicks in the longitudinal direction. And as Fred pointed out, these kicks are always in one direction. So these kicks would tend to give the polymer a direction in its tube. So we could give the tube a plus end or a minus end. And basically there will be a sort of drift towards, depending on how you define it, towards the plus end if we define that the kicks are towards that direction.
I don't understand the connection between picture A and picture B. Where is the chain along which these things are happy to move in picture A? And in other words, you're saying, what's the transition between A and B?
Okay, well, all I'm saying is that I've just taken one of these chains.
Yeah.
I don't know which one, doesn't matter. And I'm saying is I say that it's in its tube,
okay,
which is some effective potential in which it's living. And then I give it, then it's going to be moving with a certain typical velocity, which is related to the concentration of these active centers, these clumps of protein. So I'm saying that each one will typically have a certain number, and these will be kicking, and it will be moving down its tube. That.
Sort of. What's the significance of the little red arrows in the picture A?
Okay, the little red arrows in picture A are just saying that the kicks are in one direction. That the kicks are not random. They're not randomly oriented. They're always in one direction. Yeah. So what I'm just doing is I've subtracted the average value, and I see that they're going to be fluctuating about the average value.
The arrows go with the red lines, not with the blue bits. Basically.
Yeah.
It's not a motor that determines which way it kicks.
It's the filament.
Okay.
Yeah.
So you're just pointing along
the
filament.
Yeah.
Can it be that there's two motors in the filament, and one is standing, the other is moving, so it's actually compressing?
Yes, that's a possibility. That's obviously possible. And I think that things like that will become very important when you have high concentrations of myosin. And actually, their experiments, as far as I can tell, the way they get the sort of things we're predicting only happens when they do high actin concentrations and low myosin concentrations. And when they go to very high myosin concentrations, you get things like patterns forming, you get clumps, because obviously then. So actually, one of the things that we say is we can estimate essentially the separation between two of these at a certain particular concentration, and we see that for concentrations for which this separation is less than the tension propagation length, they will be acting effectively as independent force centers. So we've kind of taken a kind of an ideal gas description of these force centers, and there obviously will be a regime when they start to interact, and so then of course you would have to have a different picture. I mean, take into account interactions between. Yeah.
Do you have an estimate for this active temperature?
Yes.
What would it be?
It depends on concentration of myosin and actin.
Say for a typical experimental system.
Well, so okay, for the okay, again, it's probably easy to think about it as a ratio of the T active to T, which is, and I guess it could be something like, could be up to something like 100. Yeah.
Otherwise, perhaps I could say that one of the big mysteries in these systems as well, one of the things that would be very interesting to attack, is actually the stability of these systems. When would one to remain in a sort of a highly entangled system where things are sliding around one against the other, and when do you expect to go into much more ordered states? For instance, we've seen in the microtubule system that you mix motors and microtubules, and very, very easily and very stable, pretty much, you end up with faster-like objects, you end up with spatial organization rather than any sliding one against the other.
And I think actually asters have been seen in acting as well.
Problems, I think really the most crucial problems as well in understanding this is when can you expect the stability of a disordered state, and when do you expect to get highly ordered quasi-pneumatic states or aster states and things like that.
Don't all those spatially organized systems that have been observed involve boundaries? The asters involve boundaries.
No, actually, they not all of them. I think there's some.
There were asters without boundaries as well.
Yeah.
Because as soon as you put in boundaries, in a bunch of snakes that want to move in one way, clearly, yeah.
In Bali, you have an assembly of asters. They're less in a confined space, there's only one.
In the absence of boundaries.
In the absence of boundaries, you have all this.
There are many questions, I think, in terms of. Physicists, we don't know the Onsager criterion for transition from no orientational order to orientational order. But one can imagine that in terms of these more complicated solutions, there are also criteria which tell you whether you remain in a completely disordered state, with things just swimming around randomly, or go into some much more exotic state.
Yeah, one comment on that. We have recently completed a model where you have sticks and motors in two dimensions, similar to the model of Kara, where they find clusters. And what we find is that as a function of noise strength, you can have pneumatic ordering.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
That system.
Yes. I also did. I thought about. I did some stuff as well on that, because Yosef has done experiments and. Mm-hmm. He finds that, I mean, I don't know if I should say that, but anyway, he finds that you can get patterns depending on concentration of, as I said, actually what they find is the patterns form when the ATP runs out, which is exactly what you would imagine, that you change the noise strength, because basically what, because ATP is basically making the noise higher. Yeah. So what they find is, so that's very interesting. Okay, so.
Sorry.
Yeah.
Higher temperatures, an isotropic noise, or does it enter only the equation for the longitudinal?
It only enters in the longitudinal. And the idea is that basically the transverse motion is constrained by the tube.
But therefore, also, you should imagine that they apply kicks in between the tube in the transverse direction. So,
yes, of course.
The temperature also
I would just say that at this type of theory, it's really crude. All I would just say is that the transverse temperature is much lower than the longitudinal one. Just because, essentially, effectively speaking, what the motor, it's got to kick against something. It will kick against the softest direction. So what you've got is something which is attached to something else, which is going to go through a conventional change, and the conventional change is going to find which direction it can move along, and what we say is this direction is the longitudinal direction, because
even considering what you said before, if one motor is stalled, the other is active, and you somehow assume they are independent. I mean, the compression modulus in the longitudinal direction is larger. I mean, so it's harder to move.
Yes, but the whole point about it, as I said, the concentration at which this thing happens is low concentration. So at low concentrations, basically you can assume that they are non-interacting. And that seems to be the case.
There is a time scale where you move one, this is tall, you move this, and you don't feel any compression. Can be. You must feel some resistance to try to compress this chain.
There's a distance and a time scale. There's the typical time for a cycle, and the distance between one of these things, and if this, so basically you can compare the tension propagation length for a cycle,
yes.
Or in the typical, or for compared to the concentration, and that's what gives you the criterion for when they're interacting or non-interacting.
If you crank up the concentration of these motors or clumps of motors, you might well go to a cross-linked system that's pre-stressed.
Yes.
So I guess one safer way to address your worry is you only worry about concentration of crosslink is low enough so that each phenomenon is one. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but he wants us to have slightly longer, larger concentration, but still assume they are that far enough that they so they don't really see each other. But let's talk about the data.
Yeah, and yeah, roughly speaking, as I said, the experiments are. Wow. What happened there? Okay. And so effectively, so the punchline is that at high frequencies, we get big longitudinal fluctuations. And so this longitudinal fluctuation term can be raised to the point where it can dominate over the just the bare tension. So, and this is a sort of a schematic sort of phase diagram. So everything is now written can be related to just two parameters: this active temperature and this typical velocity of the thing inside the tube. Because of this, the T to the minus 3 quarter, this dominates at high frequencies all the time because it has a steeper slope. So if you go to a high enough, short enough time, this term will dominate. So therefore, at short times, there will always be some short T to the minus 3 quarter regime. And then at a time scale T naught, which is related to the, this thing here is T act. Unfortunately, it didn't come out very well. Okay, so basically, as T act, I guess this is T. Yeah. So basically, as the activity goes to zero, this T naught goes to infinity. So basically, For a zero active, for a term without active, this term just goes away. So therefore, this thing will just go away. So basically, so this is reasonable. And so basically, as I said, after this time T naught, this tension fluctuations dominate over the the mean tension, and then after some time T1, these tension fluctuations start feeling the effect of the tube, and basically then the dynamics of the tension fluctuations changes. It goes from being this subdiffuse dynamics to being this just diffusive. So what you're solving now is a diffusion equation with noise. So therefore it looks like a Rouse equation. So you get So basically, this T1 here is what is normally called the entanglement time, the time when the bending modes start feeling the side of the tube, and basically after this time, there's a sort of a Rouse-like regime up to a the stress relaxes until it hits the plateau. And so, I mean, so far we've kind of assumed that the plateau hasn't been changed by the effect of the activity, which is an approximation. It probably will have been changed by some small factor, but we would say it's a relatively small factor. And again, the time scale at which this thing hits the plateau will be different to the time scale for the bare system. So what we also expect that the crossover from essentially the high frequency to the low frequency behavior will be different for the active system than for the passive system.
So you're adding extra contribution to the stress, which goes as T to the minus 1/8 at early times, crossing over to T to the minus 1/2.
Yeah.
That's correct even for a straight chain, right? It doesn't have to be much longer than an LP for that.
Yeah.
What's the characteristic time scale for the crossover occurs when the tension propagation length reaches what length scale? I don't know whether it's the length of the chain or the distance between the crosslinks.
Okay, so this term here, the crossover between the teeth one eighth and
right.
Yeah, it's when it's this distance between crosslinks. It's when it reaches that.
Okay. In fact, if you put myosin in these systems, it's likely that there's also crosslinks.
Yes.
A lot of inactive factors.
Yeah.
And I could shift the plateau dramatically.
Yeah. So. Strictly speaking, yeah.
Okay, so I have a question about the physical mechanism, and you can delay it, but for the passive T of the three quarters tension term, the tension is set up by the flow field, okay, and G of T is a measure of response of the stress to the flow,
yeah.
not just stress that's present even in equilibrium.
Mm-hmm.
So one thing I've never quite understood is how does the flow field induce a longitudinal tension. I mean, that is, if I look at this term, the last equation, it's clear that that's there. You made a comment implying that that's there even in equilibrium, because the strain and the tension are correlated.
Yeah.
Okay. But is there a simple explanation of how flow induces a change in that term, as opposed to, you know, its background value in equilibrium?
Okay.
You're saying I subject it to a shear strain, and that produces a shear component to this. So I guess I don't know how the flow induces further longitudinal stress than what was there in equilibrium.
It's essentially KT per longitudinal log.
It's like collision.
Right, no, but I guess I'm asking about, I'm looking not for a scaling argument for the magnitude of the term, but an intuitive argument for how it gets induced by the flow in the first place. Are you selectively enhancing fluctuations and chains that are in particular directions? Or, that is, you know, to first approximation, this term looks like something that's there already in equilibrium.
Yes.
So I might, you know, so as you said, that would give you an isotropic contribution to the stress.
Mm-hmm.
But you're coming up with a contribution to the shear stress.
That yes.
An extra off-diagonal term that was induced by the flow.
Mm-hmm.
Is it? So do you understand how flow induces a change in that variance?
Okay. Well, I would say that.
Okay.
I would say it.
I mean, this average is done rod by rod.
Yeah.
So all that's needed is for this variance to be enhanced in rods in some orientations and suppressed in rods that are in other orientations in order for the average over rod orientations to give me an anisotropic contribution. But, you know, the way I'm thinking about this from your description is still this is just an isotropic term that's there in equilibrium.
Yes, yeah, but I don't I see just as the same as the term that you get from the curvature, that when you apply shear, you get a change in the distribution of curvatures, and I guess you also get a change in the distribution of stored excess length. I don't know.
So the strain and the tension are strongly correlated.
Yeah.
So it's you're saying that when I wrinkle a tube, so the flow field tends to do is to compress sections of chain or extend them.
Mm-hmm.
And is your point that you increase the variance as well as the mean of the strain?
Yes. I think that's it.
And you do it selectively for different orientations.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
That's solid.
Okay. So I guess I just want to say there's a number of things that can be tested here experimentally. As I'm going to say, this activity, effective activity, depends on concentration, and concentration of actin and myosin. So, and I said it, it's highest when actin is high and myosin is quite low. Obviously, it goes to zero when the myosin goes to zeros. So basically the position, this T1, T2s can be should be able to be tuned by just changing the concentration of actin and myosin. So it should be possible to be able to see these regimes, basically, if you change your sort of relative concentration of actin and myosin. So I think that would be sort of good experiments for people to try.
ATP is also a control.
Well, actually, the point, if you have myosin without ATP, then it just forms a crosslink. So it's
okay,
it's
so you're comparing crosslink and
yeah, then you then yeah, there's also the effect of crosslink. So you can estimate essentially as a distance between aggregates, which is proportional to the it depends on the motor concentration and the mesh size. And this, and then basically by assuming that these activity events are Poisson distributed with a typical sort of waiting time, which is from some multiple of the cycle time, we can estimate an active temperature. Similarly, you can estimate the typical tube velocity, drift velocity in the tube, which is related again to the typical motor force and the separation of these things. And putting in these numbers, which are sort of typical of the experiments that were done, at least by Yusuf, you can see that basically that you get something of an activity which can be of the order of 100, and you can, for long chains, you can reduce the reputation, you can reduce essentially the longest relaxation time by essentially
100% factor.
Yeah. Sorry?
Factor of 100?
No, factor of 10,000.
No, the temperature.
Oh, yes. Factor of 100, yeah.
Are you serious? I mean, 100% or 100
times 5? 100.
100.
Yeah, 100.
That's huge.
That's huge, yeah. It's a big.
Oh, but that's okay, because, I mean, these active systems, I mean, the forces that you get are always. So you can forget about temperature normally when you're in the systems. That's a rule.
That's great.
And so you can get basically reduction of relaxation times by four orders of magnitude. Again, I said there. And then these are, I mean, just sort of for putting some of these, the experiments. The experiments are not very, very good quality. These are experiments from Yusuf Kez's lab, and so they've measured the shear stress using a torsion rheometer. And okay, so this is basically the plot when you have active myosin and when you have just actin. Mm-hmm. And it's again very hard to say anything, but most of the things that we're discussing were happening at high frequencies. So at low frequencies, we see that basically it's softened, which is what we expected, because things are being pushed through the tube. But what's interesting is that it does seem to be harder at high frequencies, which agrees with this idea that we have that somehow that you have a sort of a higher temperature. So qualitatively, this seems to agree at least with the theory.
I can read the axis on the
Okay, this one here, this is the longest relaxation time, and what they do was they looked at fluorescently labeled filaments, they fluorescently labeled those, and then they took them and they observed how long it takes for them to move their contour length, and
so what's the scaling?
Okay, that's L cubed and that's L.
That's your prediction also?
Yeah, well that's just trivial, that's rotation, I mean, we end up, I think.
Just have a force that you pull, so
yeah.
Then because D is 1 over L, you get this time.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Doesn't the force grow with the length of the chain?
Sorry?
It's not, the friction coefficient goes linear with the length of the chain.
Yeah.
But it's not clear to me if the number of motors should also grow linear with the length of the chain. I might think the longer the chain got, the more force is exerted onto it, isn't it?
Because they have much bigger forces than.
Okay, so they just
it's more magnitude larger than the
quantity in that inset. That was the relaxation time.
That was the time it labeled strain. It's not clear that how that related to relaxation time. I mean,
that's usually That's usually pretty difficult to measure, and the implied error bars on those.
Yeah.
They're kind of small.
Small, yeah. So.
That's an awfully straight line.
So what they did was they took labeled.
Is this not published? Or?
It's in press. I have a preprint.
What are the? I can't read the axes on that.
This is filament length.
It's length of volume.
And this is local shear. Relaxation time.
Yeah. So what about?
And that's just as that means they've taken they just followed labeled chains and seen how long it takes for them to.
Right. But what are the times given in that? So what are the numbers in the vertical axis?
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Let's have a look. Okay. I can show that to you later if you want. I can't see.
Because you also can't follow chains very long.
I know, because right. Because they bleach, yeah, I know. So
but the statement for the passive system is much better than what it's published previously.
Mm-hmm.
It's much, it looks much cleaner.
The long times, which are
which is the slow system?
Okay.
Is the upper curve the L, the time it goes like L cubed?
That's the relaxed.
That's
weird.
Which is strange.
That goes like times.
But it's at top cube, right?
He said that's what they said. Can it be cubed?
Sorry?
Yeah.
The
lower curve is this one or that one?
The smaller one.
So this is the active filaments. So this is tracking active filaments and seeing how long it takes them to. And this is passive filaments. I track them and see how long it takes them to come out of the tube.
And the upper one is cubed.
It's cubed.
So it's not really a shear relaxation time, it's a replication time.
Yeah. So this is a replication time.
That's why it must be a cube.
Oh, not necessarily. I mean, for semi conductive polymer, it's supposed to vary from L squared to L cubed. I have a paper so I can show it to you.
Do you have cases paper?
Yeah.
This is the issue, it's resolution.
Okay.
A sticker chain is supposed to give us a square because it doesn't have to explore the other.
Okay.
Okay.
I had some stuff on just S1 mice, but I think I'll just stop there. So.
Well, what were your conclusions about the rheology curves there?
Okay. Okay. The G prime and G double prime. Yeah. Okay, well, basically, again, as I said, it's very hard. As I said, there's crosslink because they have a certain factor of dead myosin, so it's very hard to kind of sort of make quantity comparisons. But what you see there is a crossover, as I said, from high frequency and low frequencies. It happens differently for the passive and the active case, and it seems to happen later for the active case. So it means that the stress seems to be higher, again, on short time scales. Again, qualitatively, kind of agree. But I don't think you can say anything more than that. And there's no with data. Okay. So basically, those are the conclusions. And basically, that it seems that by taking the common equilibrium effect by as essentially a big fluctuation continually and the direction, which we can qualitatively account for the experimental results. Thanks.